So it's an honor to enter Jeff today, and as we go through these passages, I hope that we can find these spiritually profitable. We take a look at God's Word, and maybe have a few things to ponder over a little bit more deeply, perhaps. So there's a phrase that was from the scripture reading today in Matthew 10 in verse 16, where Jesus uses the phrase, we'll just go to that verse, start off in that verse this morning. So Matthew 10:16 says, "Behold, I am sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves, so be wise as serpents and innocent as doves." Okay. Now, like a lot of scriptures, I think that that one is easy to read over and think about it for a little bit and then maybe miss the significance of it. And so we'll take a closer look at what that's talking about once I figure out how PowerPoint works yet again. I don't use this very often, so just bear with me while... There we go. I think that's correct now. Okay. So we'll take a look at these qualities that Jesus is talking about and how they're... what they are and why they're important to us and why they matter as we go about our business that God's given us. Okay? So the title of this is Serpents and Doves, based on that phrase out of Matthew 10:16. So, if you think about it, these are two interesting qualities. And it's easy to think of one quality or the other, but I think sometimes it's a little bit tougher to grasp how they work together and how they're supposed to work together for us. Okay? So first off, we'll take a look at these. And sometimes we'll look at one, sometimes we'll look at the other, and we'll look at a combination of how they are together. And so over in Genesis 3, passage that we're familiar with. In verse 1, it says, "Now the serpent was more crafty than any other beast of the field that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, 'Did God actually say, you shall not eat of any tree in the garden?'" So the first thing that we hear from this serpent is a result of his very crafty nature. Okay. And a lot of times we associate wise with being crafty. The wiser one is, the more crafty you're able to be when it's necessary. It's not exactly the same word, but it's one of the attributes of it that normally comes to mind. And in verse 3, Eve responds to Satan. And initially, she's spot on. She responds exactly the same way that Jesus responds to Satan when Jesus is tempted by Satan. Here's what Eve says. "But God said, 'You shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die.'" Okay. All is well. Here's a temptation, but here's what God said. Okay. The serpent says some more things. And then we go down to verse 5. It says, and this is Satan speaking again, the serpent, "For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. So, when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate, and she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate." And of course, we know after that, their eyes were opened and everything changed from that point on. Now, here's the question to think about is, did they really have to eat the fruit to be wise? Because remember, Eve responded spot on initially. This is what God said. It's contrary to what Satan had presented, and this is what God said. Okay? You see, they didn't really need to eat the fruit in order to have wisdom because they already knew what God had said. So this is kind of a way of achieving wisdom apart from God. It went against God's commands. It's not what God wanted. And so as a result, innocence is lost. And we are led to the world that we live in today. Okay? We can be led astray in the same fashion when we try to achieve wisdom apart from God and go our own way. You know, you think about it too. Let's be real about the situation in the garden. Adam and Eve were together and they were alone and they were naked. I'll do the Gary looking over the glasses at you here because I just get that word picture when I think of this. You don't think there was something more, you know, that could better occupy Adam and Eve's time? I mean, rather than hunting down the one tree they weren't supposed to eat from? It just goes to show that we are easily led astray. Okay? Next, we'll take a look at Solomon over in 1 Kings 3. 1 Kings 3. And in verse 11, starting in verse 11 of 1 Kings 3, it says, "And God said to him, because you have asked this and have not asked for yourself long life or riches or the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern what is right, behold, I now do according to your word. Behold, I give you a wise and discerning mind, so that none like you has been before you, and none like you shall arise after you." God's response to Solomon's request for wisdom. So we know that when it comes to wisdom, nobody can beat Solomon. God even said so himself. Nobody's going to be like him after him, and nobody was like him before. And it's only shortly after we marvel about Solomon's wisdom and what he did in his life that unfortunately we have to think of, well, what happened at the end of his life? See, later in life, in 1 Kings 11, actually, let's back up. Before we go to 1 Kings 11, there's something interesting said in Deuteronomy 17 that we have to keep in mind when we think of Solomon. In Deuteronomy 17, starting in verse 15, this is Moses speaking, and he's able to foresee the direction that Israel's probably going to go. And he says, starting in verse 15, "You may indeed set a king over you whom the Lord your God will choose. One from among your brothers you shall set as king over you. You shall not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. Only he must not acquire many horses for himself or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again. And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold." Now, for all these things, Solomon pretty much set records, especially with the women. In 1 Kings 11, starting in verse 1, it says, "Now King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women, from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, you shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clung to these in love. He had 700 wives who were princesses and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart." So, Solomon was obviously very wise, but we just simply can't look at him as innocent. He does not fulfill that part. He was good at first. He did some fantastic things, but we see the fact that even the wisest man that could ever live is fallible and corruptible. So it's interesting that Moses warns about this back in Deuteronomy. So Solomon, very wise, but not exactly innocent. Next, we'll take a look at Abigail. Now, I think with Abigail, we're definitely moving in the right direction here. This is, I think, a fantastic example of these qualities. If we go to 1 Samuel 25. Starting in verse 5. It says, "So David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, 'Go up to Carmel, and go to Nabal, and greet him in my name, and thus you shall greet him. Peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. I hear that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we did them no harm, and they missed nothing all the time they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David.'" So David's young men came, and they said all this to Nabal in the name of David, and then they waited. And Nabal answered David's servants, "Who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take my bread and my water and give my meat that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men from whom I do not know where?" So David's young men turned away and came back and told them all this. And David said to his men, "Every man strap on his sword." And every man of them strapped on his sword. David also strapped on his sword. And about 400 men went up with David, after David, while 200 remained with the baggage. Okay. Now, it's time to act. David is a man of action, and he is about to take action that he feels is justified. Okay? Now, there's something interesting about this. If you think about David and how much he cares about the things that are under his charge and how seriously he takes his responsibilities, 1 Samuel 17 says something just amazing about David. 1 Samuel 17, in verse 34, starting in 34, it says, "But David said to Saul, 'Your servant used to keep sheep for his father. And when there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb from the flock, I went after him and struck him and delivered it out of his mouth. And if he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and struck him and killed him.'" David is a tough guy. David is the real deal. If you had to fight alongside somebody, David is who you want to fight with. You know, if we were watching over sheep and things like that, and a bear or lion came and got one of them, I don't think many of our parents would say, most of our parents would probably say, "Well, at least you're okay, right? It is a lion or it is a bear and it was hungry, so at least it didn't get more than one," right? That's not how David took this. David went after that very dangerous animal, that very tough animal, and made him give up that sheep. And then, think of how courageous this is. When the animal goes to turn on David, if that's what happened, he grabbed it by its beard and struck it until it died. Just imagine this word picture, this grabbing this animal like this when it's within arm's distance from your face and killing it. David takes his responsibilities very seriously, and he's very tough. Just think of the psalm when he talks about bending a bow of bronze. I mean, the guy is the real deal. So obviously he took his responsibilities serious, especially when it came to animals. It seems like David has kind of a special relationship when it comes to protecting animals and things. Okay. Now, back in 1 Samuel 25, in verse 14. "But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, 'Behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to greet our master, and he railed at them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we suffered no harm, and we did not miss anything when we were in the fields, as long as we went with them. They were a wall to us, both by night and by day, all the while we were with them keeping the sheep. Now therefore know this, and consider what you should do, for harm is determined against our master and against all his house. And he is such a worthless man that one cannot speak to him.'" Now, Nabal's reputation is pretty well known. If one of the servants can go directly to his wife and say, we're in trouble. And Nabal's just such a worthless man, nobody can speak to him. I mean, obviously his reputation was well known, and it was not a good one. He's about to get them all into serious trouble with David. Okay, now, David and his men protected Nabal's herds, and his men know this. And it's only because of what Abigail does here that saves them from certain disaster. In verse 18, Abigail takes quick action. It says, "Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves and 2 skins of wine and 5 sheep already prepared and 5 seas of parched grain and 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs and laid them on donkeys." Imagine how fast she must have been moving. I mean, I'm sure she probably was like, "You help me, you help me." I'm sure it was like a tag team effort here, but this is some serious whirl of activity. In verse 19, "And she said to her young men, 'Go on before me. Behold, I come after you.' But she did not tell her husband Nabal." Okay. Verse 20, "And as she rode on the donkey and came down under cover of the mountain, behold, David and his men came down toward her, and she met them. Now David had said, 'Surely in vain have I guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good. God do so to the enemies of David and more also, if by morning I leave so much as one male of all who belong to him.'" Again, David's good at what he does, and he's returned evil for good, so it's not very good. Verse 23, "When Abigail saw David, she hurried and got down from the donkey and fell before David on her face and bowed to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, 'On me alone, my lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. Let not my lord regard this worthless fellow Nabal, for so as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name and folly with him. But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my lord whom you sent. Now then, my lord, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, because the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from saving with your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my lord be as Nabal." Okay, so she presents this gift of this fantastic thing that she's put together very quickly. And this is just simply amazing. Abigail takes this quick and decisive action that would require wisdom. An immediate action on her part. And in doing so, she saves her household from certain destruction. Another aspect of Abigail's wisdom here that's worth pondering is that not only did she save her household right then, in that moment, and in that situation, but she probably also saved David from a lot of guilt later in life. See, if David would have gone through with this, if she hadn't taken this action and David would have gone through with this, it's pretty possible that later in life David would have thought about his life, pondered over the things he had done, and remembered this situation where he slaughtered this entire household because of the words of one man. And David was a man after God's heart, so he would have been guilty as he thought about this probably. I mean, I'm speculating here, but I think that another aspect of Abigail's wisdom is that she saved him from a lot of blood guilt. You know? Something he didn't have to worry about later in life, because as we know, he had other worries later in life. Now, Abigail takes the blame even though she wasn't at fault in verse 24. And this is genius, okay? Because I think that maybe she knew she'd be able to sway David's opinion a little bit, because how was David going to be as mad with her when she arrives with her servants and with, like, these donkeys heaping with all this food, right? And she says, "Oh, my lord." And she gets down on her face at his feet and just says, "Oh, I'm so sorry, it's my fault." I got a hard time imagining that David's going to be just as angry at her as he was with Nabal. So she's able to deflect this wrath. It's just genius how she handles the situation. And that's what saves this household from catastrophe, is wisdom and her innocence as well. She goes about this with such skill. Just going to throw it out there. We know David, and it probably didn't hurt that she was beautiful. It says that back in verse 4, she was beautiful and discerning. It's going to be really hard for David to be super mad with this beautiful wisdom and wise woman. But it was her discernment, it was her wisdom that averted great bloodshed. and she shows herself to be innocent. She exemplifies these characteristics in combination. Okay. Let's take a look at Daniel. Over in Daniel 5 and verse 13. Starting in verse 13, it says, "Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king answered and said to Daniel, 'You are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom the king, my father, brought from Judah. I have heard of you, that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the enchanters, have been brought in before me to read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not show the interpretation of the matter. But I have heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom.' And David answered and said before the king, 'Let your gifts before yourself and give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation.'" See, the king was aware that Daniel had wisdom. All right? And in a few verses, he proves this wisdom. Okay? In verse 25, this is how he does this. He handles this by interpreting exactly as he said he would. Verse 25, same chapter, Daniel 5. "And this is the writing that was inscribed, Mene, Mene, Tekel, and Parson. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians." Then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed with purple, a chain of gold was put around his neck, and a proclamation was made about him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed. Okay. You think about this. None of this is good news for the king. You know, his party that he's throwing in his own honor gets crashed by this writing from this hand that just suddenly appears. And the interpretation leaves nothing left for the possibility of good news for this guy. There's nothing left that he can rely on. Well, this is just the bad news that we have. Okay. Now think about this. Think about when the king brings Daniel in. And he says, "I hear that you can solve problems. You're wise." How many rulers want to admit that their wisest people can't figure something out? What do our rulers say when they can't figure something out? What kinds of things do they release as official statements? Okay, think about this. Like, you know, when everybody's confounded here, when they get all these wise men together and they're sitting around looking at each other, looking dumb, and they can't figure it out. I mean, you got to think. It reminds me of what it sounded like when all the top advisors came together shortly after September 11th, trying to figure out what happened. And what was the answer that they gave? What was the official answer that they gave? It was something to the effect of, well, we just didn't imagine that this could happen. Sorry. We just never thought. I'm not saying they should have been able to foresee it. It's the future. But the point is it's really hard for top advisors to admit they don't know something, and for the king to admit that his top advisors don't know something. But he does, and he gives the glory to Daniel. And Daniel, being truly wise, gives the glory to God. In verses 17 and 23, we can see that. So even though Daniel is able to do exactly what the king was hoping, he gives the glory to God. And if you think of Daniel in his later years, think of the lion's den. We all know that story. He was innocent of wrongdoing. Even though he was guilty by man's law, he was still innocent in God's eyes. So Daniel is a fantastic example of wisdom and innocence combined. Okay. Shrewd manager. Not really going to read this passage. Just suffice it to say, though, that he's obviously not a good example of innocence. He's getting fired because he's done something wrong of which we're not informed. But he is definitely crafty. He uses his wisdom to secure a place for himself after he's let go from his job. in the hopes that he'll have a softer landing, pretty much. And if in Luke 16, verses 1 through 9, we can examine the wisdom that he employed in trying to save his own skin, basically, after he'd made enough mistakes to get fired. So I won't examine that closely. But the excellent wife, how about Proverbs 31? This is a fabulous example. This is worthy of a sermon really all on its own. So I won't, certainly I'm not going to examine every facet of this woman. But I look at a couple verses here. We know she had many praiseworthy qualities. All right. In Proverbs 31, verses 10 through 31, we read about her, her different traits that make her who she is and why she's so praiseworthy. And one of the things is that, like in verse 16, when it says she considers a field and buys it, with the fruit of her hands she plants a vineyard. You see, she's calculating. She's not rash or impulsive. She understands the value of these things and is able to make a plan and secure it. Okay? She's good at this stuff. You know, down in verse 18, she's aware of her situation. She's a keen observer of things under her charge, and she's successful, and she's profitable. You see, all this stuff, it comes from a woman of wisdom. And she's a hard worker. Like in verse 18, at the second half of it, her lamp does not go out at night. You know, she works hard. And now this passage is likely describing this woman in different phases of her life, as we've examined in greater detail elsewhere, like in classes that we've had and whatnot. But we know that she has a great reputation. This is something that took her a lifetime to achieve. Great reputation. And we're aware of this because her husband and her children praise her. You know, she receives this commendation, rightfully so, for what she's done. Wise and innocent. Exemplifies the qualities. So now lastly, as we take a look back at Matthew 10, we can put this into greater context and see more of what Jesus is getting at here. Matthew 10, starting in verse 5, talking about the 12 apostles, which it names just previous to this. But starting in verse 5, it says, "These 12 Jesus sent out, instructing them, 'Go nowhere among the Gentiles and enter no town of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and proclaim as you go, saying, The kingdom of heaven is at hand. Heal the sick. Raise the dead, cleanse lepers, cast out demons. You receive without paying, give without pay. Acquire no gold or silver or copper for your belts, no bag for your journey, or two tunics or sandals or a staff, for the laborer deserves his food. And whatever town or village you enter, find out who is worthy in it and stay there until you depart. And as you enter the house, greet it. And if the house is worthy, let your peace come upon it. But if it is not worthy, let your peace return to you. And if anyone will not receive you or listen to your words, shake off the dust from your feet when you leave that house or town. Truly I say to you, it will be more bearable on the day of judgment for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah than for that town. Behold, I am sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. So be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. Beware of men, for they will deliver you over to courts and flog you in their synagogues. And you will be dragged before governors and kings for my sake to bear witness before them and the Gentiles. When they deliver you over, do not be anxious how you are to speak or what you are to say. For what you are to say will be given to you in that hour. For it is not you who speak, but the Spirit of your Father speaking through you." You see, these people were up against some difficult odds. And in order to do this right, they had to be wise as serpents. They had to be innocent as doves. Because they were going out in the midst, as sheep in the midst of wolves. And it's like we've been looking at in our class on Sunday mornings. That sounds very similar to the phrasing that Paul uses in Philippians 2. In verse 15, when he says, "That you may be blameless and innocent, children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world." You see, we live in the same type of generation as the early church that these passages were given directly to. we're in that same kind of situation. We've got the same kind of generation to deal with, if you will. We have the same kind of wolves that are out there. We have the same commands as the early church. Not only do we have the same situation in a lot of ways, but we have the same commands. And also, we have the same reward if we persevere. Over in Revelation, our final passage is in chapter 22 of Revelation. Revelation 22, starting in verse 11. Let the evildoer still do evil, and let the filthy still be filthy, and let the righteous still do right, and the holy still be holy. Behold, I am coming soon, bringing my recompense with me to repay each one for what he has done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. Blessed are those who wash their robes, so that they may have the right to the tree of life, and that they may enter the city by the gates. You see, when we're wise like Jesus wants us to be, and when we wash our robes and are therefore innocent as Jesus wants us to be, that's how we can partake in this eternal kingdom with him. So we have the same reward. We're up against the same difficult stuff. In some cases, less difficult stuff. Nobody's probably going to be thrown in jail for being a Christian today. Can't say the same will remain for the rest of our lives, but for now, we've got that part easy. So we really have to persevere and make sure that we get this thing right. So I hope that this has been spiritually profitable, taking a closer look at that aspect of innocent as doves and wise as serpents as we go about our time of shining as lights in the world in a crooked and twisted generation, being sheep in the midst of wolves, up against scary odds, but nonetheless, God is with us. So if we persevere, if we wash our robes, we win, ultimately, in the end. And we got to lead as many to do the same. That's today's lesson. If there's anyone here who is in need to either be baptized or if you need prayers for whatever reason, then we can definitely pray for you and assist you in whatever way. So if either one of those things is you, then feel free to make your way forward while we stand and sing a song.